Welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. I am your host, Aaron Erber. This is a podcast about stories, myths, and the Catholic faith. Welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. I'm your host, Aaron, and today I have I don't even know how to describe this, but just I have Mark Millar from Marvel Comics, Marvel DC, who has written such comics as Superman Red Son, The Ultimates from the Avengers, and Old Man Logan, and a bunch of other stuff, many of these comics have been turned into movies. Just welcome. I don't even know how to start this. Just welcome, Mark Millar. Please give us some background to yourself.
Well, yeah, I mean, my goodness, I guess my two jobs, I'm a comic book writer and I'm an executive at Netflix. You know, like all I ever wanted to do was write Superman, and I somehow stumbled into a comic book career and a Hollywood career, you know, but all I wanted to do was write Superman comics, you know, so every day I'm just happy I've avoided a real job. Those are my two things, comic books.
Yeah, so how did you get into comic books and superheroes?
As a kid, I can't remember not being into them. I just can't remember not. You know the way if you're a professional footballer, you were in your back garden with a ball from you could stand up? You know, it's pre-memory for me, you know, you just have hazy memories of before 5 years old. So I can't remember not loving this stuff. But I do remember my earliest fixations. And there was a Superman and Batman cartoon on when I was a little kid, when I was maybe four. And I remember I used to watch these guys. And I'm not even sure what period of American television this is from. But I just loved them. I was totally into it from the word go. And then I found out there was comic books of these guys and there was toys of these guys. And it opened up a whole world to me. And my older brothers, I've got one older sister and four older brothers. And they're all in, well, they were into it to varying degrees, but one of my brothers was really into it. And it was back in the day when it was kind of embarrassing to be into comic books, which is kind of weird now because everyone's into comic book characters.
Right.
But when I was little, my brother, who was, you know, 14 years older than me, he was really embarrassed. I've been into them, so he used to buy them for himself, pretending they were for me, and I read them once he'd finished with them. So yeah, it was brilliant. Yeah, I feel sorry for kids who didn't grow up loving comic books. It was so fun.
Yeah, that's my background too. So I grew up watching like the Batman animated series, you know, and the Superman animated series and the Justice League and all that stuff. So I grew up with those and reading my dad's comics. You know, my dad would collect them and I'd read some of his. And I get the embarrassment aspect of it, because even when I was a kid, I think it was still kind of like, but it was before, you know, all the Marvel before the Marvel movies really made it popular, you know. Definitely there was a little bit of embarrassment. I don't really get why. I mean, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. It should be just a hobby like anything else, but
And as an art form, like, people are very comfortable with words as an art form, like prose, and they're very comfortable with art as an art form, you know. But somehow when you combine the two and make a comic book, then people used to be really embarrassed about it. So when I was a kid, really, if you were still reading them after about 12, you were laughed at for it, you know. So but I learned to kind of keep it quiet how much I love this stuff, and I would just tell my sort of intimate circle at school.
Right. Yep, you know, I get that exactly. Yeah, so what companies have you written for, and which stories did you enjoy the most writing?
Well, like I say, I had a plan as a kid, you know, which was to try and do something like Superman, and there was a path to getting there. You had to work in British comics. Mm-hmm. As a Scottish guy, you know, I live in the UK, and my plan was British comics, which would then lead to American comics at Marvel and DC. And I did a few years at DC, but never quite clicked. You know, I was in my 20s, and I was just kind of using the gigs I was doing to get the superhero gigs I really wanted. So I was doing horror comics and all that kind of stuff. That wasn't really my thing. I liked it, but I didn't love it. And I never quite got to drive the family car. Like, my big break didn't come until after I left DC. Then I get into Marvel, and then I was incredibly lucky. Like, my big break came around the time I went to Marvel, and suddenly everybody was reading my stuff. So my first thing at Marvel was their number one book immediately, you know, and then the second thing I did became the number one book, and I just did such a nice little run. Mm-hmm. I did about there's a Marvel in everything kind of worked out. It was just, you know, sometimes in life, you're working with the right people, you're working for the right people, and you're kind of in a great environment where everybody's just doing their best. And that was just one of those periods. I had an absolute ball my 9 years at Marvel. It was just great fun. I mean, I was drunk for about 50%. You know, it was like a decade-long party. It was fantastic.
Wow. And what was your first Marvel comic that broke number one then?
Marvel at the time, they were kind of keen to embrace a mainstream audience again. They were a little worried they'd become a little insular, and they were just going for guys who were already reading the books, and they felt as if they were starting to decline in sales across the line. So they came up with this idea, which was very clever, which is they said, look, these books have been around for 40 years. It's kind of hard for new readers to kind of come in and understand it.
Yeah.
So we need somebody to reinvent the wheel, you know, to come in and do Spider-Man from scratch, as if Spider-Man was just happening now and issue one was just sitting in the stands now, to come in and do X-Men, you know. And my friend Brian Bendis was given Spider-Man and I was given X-Men. And the idea was just to reinvent it for a modern audience who'd never read an X-Men comic before. And it worked out great. The guys we were working for, Joe Quesada and Bill James, were like, they're the guys who saved Marvel. You know, Marvel was going into bankruptcy around that period. And these guys came in and just turned the ship around. It was just great fun. And it was lovely after maybe 5 or 6 years of decline for the company to just see it go from strength to strength.
Yeah.
So I had Fortune magazine in 2002, 2 years into their run, called them they were on the cover, and they were called the biggest success story of 2002. And it was just great, you know, because we all thought our checks were going to bounce. You know, we didn't think we were going to get paid. So it was great to do something you love and it working out really well.
Yeah. Was that the Ultimates then? Was that...
That was my next thing.
Oh, that was the next thing. Okay.
Because Ultimate X-Men had gone so well, I got the chance to do my version of the Avengers.
Right.
So I got to reinvent Captain America, Thor, Iron Man, Hulk, and I got the world's greatest comic book artist, Brian Hitch, you know, to be my partner in this as well. You know, he drew these books. It was just fantastic. Again, if the stars hadn't aligned, it wouldn't have worked in the same way. So it was just a great period. And at this point, the Marvel movies were starting to happen. So they were starting to look at the comic books and think, okay, what can we turn into films? And the Hollywood guys then noticed me because my stuff was very filmic and everything, you know. So opened up a whole career I never expected, which was they were translating my stuff into movies. And that then led me to start my own company and leave Marvel to do my own movies and comic books.
Wow. So that would, the Ultimates were heavily influential on the Avengers movie, right? That came out in 2012. Is that when it came out?
Intentionally on my part, you know, because I was just trying to do a good comic book.
Right,
you know?
For
me, it was actually a happy accident because what they wanted to do was try and get the publishing line in good shape. So they created this Ultimate line of books where they reinvented all of these characters for a mainstream audience. But as it turns out, that interpretation worked very well in film as well. So you see things like Brian Bendis' Ultimate Spider-Man. You see a lot of that stuff appearing in the Spider-Man movies because it was a fresh take on Spider-Man.
Right.
And similarly, you know, with X-Men to some extent, but especially with Ultimates, you could see that, you know, being the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So friends of mine who were working on those movies, directors and writers, they would say they would have the pages of our books, you know, up all over the studio at Marvel. And, you know, Zach Penn, the screenwriter of The Avengers, and he wrote The Incredible Hulk as well, he said his plan was essentially just to adapt this, you know? So that's what led Stan Lee to say to me, Stan said, look, I feel you're good at coming up with new takes on things and coming up with new ideas. You should create your own characters. And when Stan Lee tells you to do something, you do it. You know? Right. That's like God talking to Moses, isn't it? You know, I'm kind of like, yeah, okay, I'll do that, Stan. And it was great. It worked out really well. I mean, as it turns out, Stan's really smart.
Yeah, who would have thought, you know? Who would have thought Stan Lee would know what he was talking about? Well, that's super cool. And so how this kind of, this interview kind of came about. So on Twitter, I'm fairly active on Twitter. And one of my, follower friends, whatever, on Twitter, had a thread about you, about Mark Millar, and kind of comparing you to Neil Gaiman and how, you know, he's a bit more critical of Neil Gaiman. I'm a little bit more critical of Neil Gaiman. We're not going to talk about Neil Gaiman, but how you had a thread of like your comics and, you know, you kind of go like, you write, you know, just fun adventure stuff, or sometimes it's deeper, you know, but you're always just really enthusiastic. And I'm like, oh yeah, Mark Millar, he's, I have a lot of his books. And I didn't click that you had you wrote Wanted, Kick-Ass, and Red Superman, Red Sun, and all these other ones. And I'm like, holy crap! He wrote all these comics that I have read. I don't own Wanted or Kick-Ass anymore. I had a comic purge. I'm sorry. I had a comic purge a few years ago, and they didn't make the cut. But I did keep some of your other stuff. But I didn't get you were the same author. So
you at least pretended it was a fire or something. You lost the fire.
But, yeah. So I'm like, oh yeah, Mark Millar. And then another guy said, oh, he's Catholic. I'm like, he's Catholic? What are you talking about? He's Catholic. And so I kind of Googled you a bit. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's crazy. And then I tagged you. I'm like, hey, if you ever want to come on the show, I did not expect you to respond at all. And then you messaged me like, yeah, sure. What time? And so I sat there like thunderstruck for 5 minutes. I'm like, I don't even know how to respond to this. So eventually I did. And then here we are. So you're, you know, very public, as I was reading in some of your interviews about your Catholic faith. Did you grow up Catholic? Are you a convert? Like, how did, like, you go into as much detail as you want, about that.
Yeah, no, I love being a Catholic, and one of the things I love about being a Catholic is the element of surprise.
Yeah, yeah.
Like as unusual now, you know, especially in the media, if you work in the media to be a Catholic, you know, right. And like Catholics are like, we're like the last people you can still attack, isn't it? You know, like,
right.
Catholic, I mean, it's rare to watch a TV show or a movie where somebody isn't getting a dig in at Catholicism or something like right. that. You know, it's like, we are an unprotected species, really, you know? But I love being a Catholic, you know, I mean, it's part of my entire identity, you know, like, I mean, my family are Catholic going back as far as anyone can look into our genealogy, you know, so we're very culturally Catholic, but at the same time, I love the fact that it's a rarity. I think I'm quite a contrarian by nature, you know, I kind of like to go against the grain of what everyone else is doing,
right.
So in the particular Western world, you know, and especially in the media, I love the fact that I can drop a bomb in there that I'm a Catholic. I'm like, you know, so I'll give you a super fast example. I was at a dinner party about 10 plus years ago in Hollywood, and there was a lot of people, you know, maybe 14, 16 people around this table, and the subject went to religion and people were talking about it. And, you know, most people were atheist, agnostic, you know, Hollywood tends to be, you know, and, you know, a couple of Buddhists there and everything, you know. And there was even two people from the music industry who claimed they were Satans, right? Which was really odd, right? So, like, so around the table, we're all chatting about it. And everybody was really interested in everybody else's sort of take on spirituality. And even the Satanists, you know, people were kind of saying, oh, that's really interesting, you're a Satanist. Oh, you know, that's well done, you know, I can
think,
well, you know,
done.
And then when it came to me, they said, what were you? And I said, I'm a Catholic. And everybody burst out laughing. They thought I was kidding.
Oh,
and I was like, no, I'm a Catholic, you know, and they said, well, obviously not anymore. And I was like, no, I kind of go to church most weeks, you know, I go most Sundays, and even sometimes during the week I'll pop my head in and light a candle or something, you know, and like, and everybody, like, it was the most shocking thing they'd ever heard, and even the Satanists were like, what? You know, they couldn't believe it, you know.
Wow, yeah.
So it's so rare now that I kind of like the punkiness of it, you know, that it's such a surprise, and I think as a writer, it's always quite good to be a little different from everybody else.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's like, I don't want to say a blessing, you know, but it is a gift, you know. So I think you have a different perspective on the world, and people pay money for your perspective. That's what the job of a writer is. That's the relationship with the reader. So if you can give somebody a perspective they don't have, that's a valuable thing.
Definitely. Well, there's one of my favorite authors. I have to mention him on every episode. His name is Tim Powers. I don't know if you've ever heard of Tim Powers. He wrote the book On Stranger Tides, which became pretty much the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise, right?
Yes.
But he's a devout Catholic as well, and he says pretty much the same thing. He's a contrarian by nature, and he likes to be the one of the only Catholics in the science fiction, like practicing Catholics in the science fiction world, because it's so shocking to people. I mean, he also loves his faith too, but there's definitely that element that, and I, you know, I used to work at a university that was very secular, and it was the same kind of thing. You know, I would say, oh, I'm a practicing Catholic. And they're like, what? You know, like I was a rare species of bird to them, you know, like just this exotic like bird that they don't know what to do with. So yeah, there's definitely that the contrarian element can be kind of fun, you know. it can be annoying sometimes, but especially
I was in a where not a lot of people weren't Catholics, you know, so it's kind of, this will seem odd to Americans, but like, it was kind of like Dublin and Ireland or something like that, you know, where everybody was very culturally Catholic. So a lot of people were Scots-Irish in my neighborhood, you know, so Catholicism was just endemic. So, for example, there was 6,000 people in my neighborhood, and there was one Catholic church. So on a Sunday, there was 5 services, and everyone was standing room only. You had to stand at the back of the church if you didn't get there 10 minutes early, that kind of thing.
Right.
So it was a Catholic. So I grew up thinking that's what the world was.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was shocked once I became like a teenager, you know, once I hit 17, 18, and then discovered there's some people out there who are not Catholics, you know, so.
Yeah, that is a different experience than what I had growing up. Definitely different. But because I grew up kind of Catholic too, but it wasn't as culturally everywhere, you know. That's funny. So when you're writing stories, how does your Catholic faith kind of influence your storytelling and your choices as a writer?
You know, I think it probably so intrinsic that it's impossible for me to recognize. You know, without going back and really thinking about each project in itself, it's a bit like being a Scottish guy or being a man or being a dad or being a husband, you know, all these things inform who you are, which is how you inform what you write as well, isn't it? You know, so if I really think about it, I can trace everything I've ever written back to something I've read or been told or something like this, you know? So I think it's just so culturally rich, that Catholic world, that it sets you up actually quite well for an outrageous world like doing superheroes or whatever, you know, like for me, it doesn't seem that crazy for somebody to perform in miracles or doing good deeds or whatever, you know, it's like, if you grew up in a culture of detective shows, then it's very hard to make that jump to doing superhero comics, you know. But if you grew up with the Bible, which is actually full of almost comic book imagery, isn't it? Whether it's the Red Sea's parting or the Garden of Eden or serpents talking to people, you know, these are like scenes out of comic book, really, you know. So for me, it was a very natural progression to go from, you know, Jesus to Superman.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that's, you know, part of like, and then it was kind of, so I'm a revert to the faith, and part of growing up, what made it possible and you know, for me to come back to the church was reading comic books, because when I was reading those comics, I wanted this stuff to be true on some level, right? And then when I came back to the church, like, wow, all these miracles and all these saints and all, like, so like, this is kind of true. All these superheroes are kind of real in a way, you know? And so it was very much my imagination was already kind of primed for that. And so, yeah, coming back to the church wasn't as difficult for me because I wasn't really an atheist, right? I kind of like wanted the miraculous to be true already, you know? So yeah, it's, they kind of go back and forth, like the biblical imagery and the comic book storytelling. I mean, it's kind of intuitive on one level, but you don't always think about it like that.
And it's like I said earlier about, like, I see it as a real lucky thing that I got into comic books, and it's the same way, I guess, with Catholicism as well. You know, I see it as quite a lucky thing because it's something to hold on to, you know, when things are hard in your life, which is inevitable in everybody's life, there's going to be times that are tough. And whether, you know, nobody has any empirical proof one way or the other of anything, you know, but like, whether it's true or not, hope's a really powerful thing, you know, so prayer's a powerful thing, hope's a powerful thing, positive thoughts are a powerful thing. So I've always found in periods of my life where things are hard, it's nice to have that little thing to hang on to.
Right. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. So some of your stories, like not necessarily your Marvel or DC stuff, but some of your later writings, like Wanted and Kick-Ass, they have a lot of like ultra violence, some sexuality and profanity. I was trying to remember because I haven't read some of that stuff in a while. I don't know if you have any nudity in your comics. I can't remember now, but
probably somewhere, I'm sure. Yeah.
Probably, yeah. I couldn't remember. I mean, it wasn't anything, I don't think, gratuitous. But So how do you, when you're writing that stuff, how do you handle that subject matter as a Christian?
You know, I come to everything as a writer before anything, you know, so I think the ultimate duty of the writer is honesty, you know, so if you're writing a scene with a bunch of gangsters sitting around the table, you know, they are not going to talk, you know, like a bunch of grade school teachers talking around the table, you know, it's like it's going to say that the language that they use will be different, the level of aggression will be different and so on, you know, so you have to be true to the scene that you're writing, and for me, that's what always comes first. And I think I mix up what I do, you know, like I've done Kingsman, Kick-Ass, Wanted, that kind of thing, which are I'm pretty mature, but at the same time, I'll do lighter things as well, whether it's a Marvel DC or the stuff I do myself too, you know, like for Millward, my own company that I sold to Netflix. You know, so sometimes I'll do family-friendly stuff and sometimes I don't. But I think it's really important as a writer to mix it up, because if you do the same thing, you know, you want your career to be 40 or 50 years long. Right. So you want to really mix it up. And sometimes I love following a really adult theme thing with something that's all ages. And then I love then to go back to doing something adult. But the stuff I love is really varied. Like, my favourite things are stuff I loved as a kid. But at the same time, I as a teenager, I loved Clint Eastwood. I loved John Wayne. I love a big gunfight. You know, I don't like the idea of people shooting each other in real life, but I do love watching that in movies. It's really fun.
You know? Right, yeah.
I think that's probably the line that I would draw is, you know, I'd say, if you're a Catholic, there's no moral dilemma to seeing ultraviolence on screen, but just don't practice it.
Right. Yeah. When you start doing it in real life, that's when the sins start piling up, right?
That's the wrong cut.
Yeah. It's really interesting, especially, yeah, definitely, like, the gangsters aren't going to be, you know, they're not going to be talking like we're talking, right? Like, polite and few profanities, right? And then one thing I read about your personal life is, like, you know, in Wanted and all these, like, there's a lot of profanity, right? And you say that you never use profanity in your personal life. At least that's what I read. I don't know if that's true.
I mean, if I drop something or whatever, you know, my kids have never heard me swear, for example. You know, like, but I never heard my parents swear, you know. I remember hearing my dad when I was about 8, I heard my dad say ass, right? I was so shocked that even now as a middle-aged man, I can remember my dad saying
ass. Yeah.
I was like, because it was so out of character, you know. And I've done the same thing with the kids. But yeah, I mean, if you're cracking a joke or something like that, of course you will, you know. But you can try and live as decent a life as you possibly can, you know. But our family, it's a little bit of a thing in our family. I'll tell you a quick funny story. One of my brothers is really into flying, right? So he's got his pilot's license. He's done it for years, and he flies sometimes a little thing called a microlight. I don't know if you're familiar with microlights,
no. But
it's like a go-kart in the sky, you know. So it's something you sit inside, you're exposed to all the elements, and then you have a kite above you and you fly like 2 miles in the sky, you know. It's super dangerous, right? But he and one of my other brothers were up in it, and they had little radio headsets on. They were flying and they hit an air pocket and they fell for like a mile or something. It was insane, and the sail flipped back and they were going to die, and then they somehow managed to get it under control again. And then whenever they landed, you know, my brother was really relieved and everything, but my other brother wasn't speaking to him, and he was angry at him. And he said, what are you annoyed at? He said, there was no need for that language as you were falling through the sky. You know? No, only in our family would somebody say something like that, but he was genuinely annoyed at him, you know, as he was falling to his death.
Yeah, right, yes. No need for that language. Come on. That's really funny. Yeah, so let's see. You get so yeah. Speaking to that, so this kind of maybe we talked about this already, but when you get into the heads of your characters, who obviously can be very immoral, like the main character in Wanted, or someone who is trying truly to be a hero, like I can't remember the hero in Kick-Ass, but. How do you get into their heads, especially when they don't share a morality, you know, like someone like the main character in Wanted, who becomes very immoral by the end, you know, or does he, you know, he's not as bad as the other villains, right? But
what I wanted to do was do the reverse Spider-Man, which is that somebody who is, hang on, this power I've been given, I can use absolutely to my own ends, you know. Interesting, because normally the hero's journey goes in the opposite direction. So it's kind of interesting watching somebody sort of like go like that, you know, to go down, you know, instead of elevating themselves, which is most superhero stories for the last 80 years. So that was kind of interesting to me. But I just think if you write every character to have your sensibilities, then those are going to get pretty boring pretty fast, you know, because all the support characters are going to be the same as well, you know, and it's going to be pretty dull. I mean, one of the beautiful things about literature and the world itself is, you know, different characters, different voices, different personalities, you know. So like Mario Puzo, for example, you know, when he wrote The Godfather, he Michael Corleone is very different from the Clark Kent who wrote when he wrote Superman the movie, you know? But yeah, they're both Mario Puzo's take on those characters. And that's the joy of being a writer. There was a weird thing a few years ago where people felt you could only really write characters that were like you, you know? And they all, I mean, I used to get this all the time. People would say, I cannot believe you condone what your characters are doing. And I was like, I'm not. That's just you know, like Bob Kane did not condone the death of Bruce Wayne's parents when they were shot in that alley. It was just the origin of Batman, you know.
Right.
But it was a weird level of idiocy for a little while, you know, in culture where people mistook the writer and the art itself, you know. But in reality, there's a thousand aspects to our personalities and everything as well. And you can dig deep on something, or you can base things on somebody who you know, and it's nothing like you at all. I do that all the time. And what's awful, actually, is now that my stuff has been made into movies, I'm sometimes sitting in the cinema at a premiere, because I have these big friends and family premieres for every one of my movies, and I'm sometimes sitting beside somebody who's an element of their life I've used in the... It happens all the time, because nearly everything I do is based on, like, a pal or something.
Sure.
So I think that's what makes books interesting, though, isn't it? You know, just something you've never tried before and something they've never read before.
And then, so that is a very common problem, I think, especially in, you know, literary criticism, to mistake the actions of a character with the views of an author, right? So, like,
I think modern problem. I don't think this was the case 10 years ago, even. I think this is a modern problem.
Yeah, yeah. It's something I've come across, too. It's like, well, this author, you know, has this character do this. I'm like, yeah, that's not a good thing. And the author, like, you can clearly tell it's how the character ends up. It wasn't good that he did that, right? Like he lost an arm or he, you know, whatever. But yeah, it is something I've been noticing too. People just kind of get the author and the work kind of mixed up, right? So, yeah.
I think it's an intellectual infantilism, really, though, isn't it? I think it's people who can't disassociate work from personality, you know. But I think it's a temporary thing. I think it's a temporary idiocy, I think, in culture, which I think is already kind of at an end, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, I think we were more sophisticated 10 plus years ago, and we're becoming more sophisticated again. I think it was essentially the Twitter age. It was a kind of 10-year you know, where people looked to have something to be outraged by, but they weren't even really that outraged, you know. They were just looking for likes and followers,
right? No, that's true. I think that's completely correct. People are faking outrage all the time about whatever. It's like, this something happens and like it doesn't affect them at all, and they're really mad about it. You know, it's like, okay, well, what is you being mad going to do about this situation? It's nothing. You know, you just do it for attention.
It's easier to destroy than create, isn't it? You know, so if they can't make a name for themselves as creatives, they will make a name for themselves as destroyers.
Right.
Realizes that there's only a limited amount of things you can destroy until you have no culture left, which I think we were in danger of for a little while. But at the same time, it's not a career being a destroyer. You know, I'm much more impressed by people who go away and learn how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yep. There's whole YouTube channels devoted to being angry at whatever, you know. So, and that's not what I try to do with this podcast. So, I want to highlight good stories and good creators and stuff. So, but I think we should maybe move on to, well, no, hold on. What do you think to be your, what do you consider to be your most Catholic story?
That's interesting. You know, there's an easy answer to that. A book called American Jesus.
Yeah. I haven't read that one, but, I've heard about it. Yeah.
It is but you'll have to, we've just finished season one of the Netflix show.
Okay.
That'll be out in 2023, at 18 weeks filming in Mexico. So the idea of that's super Catholic, you know, is about a kid who knows he's a little different and he doesn't know what it is, but he finds out he's the returned Jesus for Revelation. You know, he's the guy who's come back to face the Antichrist in the desert of Megiddo, and, you know, the fate of the world rests on his shoulders. So it's kind of the Omen in reverse.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
But he's back to do ultimate good. And that's probably my most Catholic thing. There's a Catholic priest in it who's one of the main characters who's entirely positive.
Mm-hmm.
We've never seen, you know. Yeah. He's actually he's a good guy. You know, he's a really good guy. And I kind of like that. The last time I think I remember seeing a Catholic priest who was a great character in that, was Exorcist 3 and Exorcist 1 as well, you know, okay. as I said. I loved, I don't know if you've seen the third Exorcist movie, but it's really, really good. And there's a hero priest in the Exorcist, which I love as well, you know, like, the spoilers for the movie, you know, but the priest saves the girl by sacrificing himself, you know?
Yep.
And you never see that, though, you know, so I like the idea of a hero priest story, because every priest we ever had was a great guy, like, and in our neighbourhood, like I said, there was one parish with three priests in it, and they were a big part of our life. I mean, I was an altar boy, so I saw three things a week as an altar boy, you know, but I would also, my mum would have the priest for dinner once a month or something, you know, but they were away from their families, you know, they were living in a church house away from their own families, so people tried to kind of make them part of the community, so I only get really happy, nice memories of priests, you know, so I kind of like seeing them represented well on screen.
Yeah, I think the last time I saw a positive, like almost a purely positive depiction of Catholicism was actually in Daredevil, the show on Netflix.
Season one.
Yeah. So that's probably one of the most recent and one of the only like popular culture depictions of Catholicism that was actually fairly positive, you know, and pretty accurate in terms of theology and whatnot, you know, and the depictions of how, you know, Matt Murdock struggles with his faith and stuff. But there isn't much, you know, that was a big one, but there really isn't much out there other than Catholic creators who are writing, you know, independently. Moving on to, I want to talk about Superman a little bit. And you said Superman is your favorite superhero, and you got into comics because you wanted to write Superman comics, and you have written Superman comics. So what is it about Superman that draws you to his character, and why do you think he's so popular with people?
I think he represents the best of what America is, you know. So America is a very attractive thing. Like, Americans have forgotten how attractive America is, right? You know, it's an odd thing, but when I was growing up, I wanted to be American. Like, I had an American flag up in my room and everything, you know. I mean, I'm in another country, you know, but I loved it. Culture, that all the TV shows I watch were American, all the movies I watch were American. And Scotland has a real love affair with America. Scotland and Ireland both have a real love affair with America. And nothing represented America to me more than Superman, because the costume looks like the American flag. And you know, there are negative aspects to every country, and especially a superpower like America, you know, whether it's wars, whatever, you know, but especially as a kid, you can only see the good, you know, and just the basic fundamentals of it, the fact that Americans are citizens and not subjects, the fact that they're not ruled by anyone, they're free people and everything, you know. I mean, even on my passport, I'm a subject of the king now, you know.
Yep.
So there's something pretty cool about democracy. And you have to remember, I can't remember the exact stat, but it's something crazy, that only 20% of the world get to vote, which is quite a...
Wow, yeah.
When you think about it like that, that's a crazy stat. And what we understand as democracy, only 20% of the world's, you know, take part in that, where they choose who's ruling them. And, you know, I just always found it an American attractive thing. And superheroes were American, you know, so it always seemed cool to me. I couldn't wait to go to New York and see these tall buildings, Spider-Man, all this, you know. And I thought it was all real when I was a kid. I always thought superheroes were real. I didn't realize until I was about seven. These things were fictional, you know. So Superman, he was the king of them all, though. He had all the best superpowers. You know, he was stronger and faster than everybody else, you know. So he was just my favorite. But I also like the fact his adventures could take you anywhere. He could travel through time. He could travel through space.
Yeah.
You know, he could go anywhere, really. You know, so the stories were kept limitless. And as a kid, that's really exciting because they can be about him. Batman was stuck wherever his car could take him on a tank of gas, you know.
Like, Yeah, so in the introduction to your Superman Red Son, which is one of my favorite takes on Superman, the intro says, I can't remember who wrote it, but your favorite color seems to be gray in terms of morality. Do you agree with that assessment?
I don't like things to be gray. You know, I much prefer things to be black and white, but the reality is it is gray, you know, because no bad person is entirely bad. No good person is without their flaws, you know. So that is interesting. And the idea of flipping Superman and having him grow up in Stalin's Russia was really interesting. I like I like the idea of always flipping a story to me. Like Wanted was my inverse of Spider-Man. Like yeah. Wesley Gibson, who James McAvoy played in the movie, was my Peter Parker, but flipped, you know? Mm-hmm. And I like to flip it because that's immediately a take you've never seen before. Everybody understands the Americana of Superman, but to then flip that on his head and make him a communist
right.
and have a handle on his chest instead of the Superman S, the story kind of wrote itself. It was really, really immediately interesting to me.
Yeah, he grows up in, instead of landing in Kansas, he grows up in in the Ukraine under Stalin's Russia in a collective farm. So he's, and it's a very interesting comic because he still has that Superman sort of, I don't know how to say it, but his he wants to do good still, right? He wants to do good, but how he goes about doing that with like communistic principles ends up with him being a totalitarian dictator.
Yes. So think about it. He was raised on a Midwest farm by two nice people, you know,
right.
And taught him the value of humility and you know, never tell anyone really what to do to serve other people, you know. Whereas in my story, he grew up in a collective farm, was handed over to Stalin as a baby, you know, because the family structure was different. He was handed into the government, and then he did what the government wanted. So the government wanted to take over other neighboring countries, mm-hmm. and they used Superman to do it. So the Warsaw Pact, instead of the Warsaw Pact disappearing, the Warsaw Pact expanded all over the world.
Right.
And Superman was invading these countries. They didn't need tanks, they had Superman. So everything, Australia, New Zealand, China, everything, you know, was under Superman's rule. And America was the last place standing. And the one person who would take on this Superman who's taken over the whole world with this massive communist government is Lex Luthor, right. The one guy qualified, so he becomes president to stand up to President Superman.
Yeah, that was the most interesting element of it, is Luthor, although he has a lot of selfish motivations for defeating Superman, he mm-hmm. actually does a lot of good, whereas Superman, his motivation seems on the surface to be altruistic, right? But he, the biggest telling moment that Superman is morally corrupt in Red Sun is when he is, spoilers, when he's captured by the anarchist Batman, which is one of my favorite characters. He's an anarchist going against Superman, and he's captured him, and he's got him in this Red Sun chamber to diminish him of his powers, and Wonder Woman's tied up, you know, with her own magic lasso. And Superman asks Wonder Woman, who loves him, right,
yeah.
to break her own lasso to free him, which
yeah.
which the real Superman would never do. He'd never ask yeah. that, right?
So
he's completely selfish, right? He's selfish, only looking after himself. And there are moments where he says that human conversations have begun to bore him, so he just goes around and does whatever he wants, you know. And but he's ultimately this selfish character, and he realizes that at the end, which is
I would say more of a control freak, you know.
Yeah.
Where like the real Superman, you know, is somebody who serves humanity, you know, like
right.
it's a more of a Christ-like thing, isn't it? You know, he would do anything for other people. Whereas this Superman believes in the power of government over the individual. So this Superman ultimately believes the state knows best.
Right.
But he believes that with all of his heart, you know, and he thinks he's doing the right thing. You know, so he has eliminated poverty and starvation and everything. So the Western world allows these things to exist because it's a free market. Right. Really, you know, you're not going to go and control other countries. But he sees a moral authority in the fact that he has eliminated crime, you know, but at what price? The price is global dictatorship.
Right.
So, and it's that moment, I don't want to spoil the ending, but it's that moment where he realizes he's as bad as anything he's ever fought, you know, really by the end.
Yeah, exactly. He's as bad as Brainiac. That's what he realizes. And that's why it's one of my favorite Superman comics, because it so perfectly both captures the true Superman like ethos, but almost in a negative light, right? So you kind of it's like the photo negative version of Superman, but in portraying him like that, it shows how the original Superman actually is goodness. He actually embodies goodness and self sacrifice. So that's why it's doing multiple things.
You know, I think the most important thing about Superman is that he's the most powerful person on the planet, but he dresses up as the weakest guy in the office.
Yeah.
You know, he has total humility, and that's what he learned on the farm, isn't it? You know, like to he recognizes the beauty of humanity and to let people do their own thing.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And then you have little things that I also found interesting, like Luthor becomes basically a trade isolationist, right? So that's how he saves the country. So that's how he saves the economy of the United States. Is he's like, well, we're not gonna trade with anybody else. We're just gonna do everything here in our own country. And then he like doubles the standard of living in like 6 months, and like, you know, quadruples it in a year. And Wonder Woman hints that Nixon was better than Kennedy because Kennedy let everything go to pot. You know, it's so it's interesting. Does that, I don't want to get too political, but does that reflect any of your own political views at all, or no?
No, I just like playing around with it. You know, yeah. I mean, the honest truth is, you just got to let the story flow where the story's going to flow. You know, mm-hmm. like people read it and get their own things out of it, which I love. I love the fact that a conservative will read it and feel a connection, and a liberal will read it and absolutely feel the connection as well. Like, people at the absolute polar opposites, like communists have read it,
yeah,
and said, I love this, I totally get it, it's communist Superman. And the t-shirt was a very popular t-shirt, you know,
yeah, I can imagine.
You know, but I love that. I think, to me, whenever a writer preaches and tells you what you should think, that's when you should close the book and run away from the store as fast as possible, you know. like I think the job of a writer is to entertain you, really. I think it's certainly a fictional writer, you know, and every character meant something useful to say. Like, for example, when I was doing the Ultimates, I was writing Captain America, Thor, and Iron Man, and people were really confused because they would hear what I said as Captain America and they thought that was me, but then they said, that's nothing like the way you write Thor or Iron Man. So I understand this, you know, which one are you? And I'm like, I'm none of these guys, you know. So Captain America would be relatively conservative because, my God, he grew up at you know, the 1930s, going into the 1940s. FDR was his president, right. And then he started defrosted in the modern world. So he would be quite socially conservative. Of course he would, because he looks like Brad Pitt, but he would hang out with your grandfather, you know, like,
right, yeah.
Ideals are FDR's ideals, probably, really, you know. Whereas Tony Stark is probably much more of a libertarian, you know. So Tony Stark was all about the free market. He was an arms dealer, mm-hmm. before you know, when Stark International didn't have Iron Man. So, like, whereas Thor, I think, would be an entirely different thing altogether. He would, you know, probably be the liberal's liberal. You know, Thor would be like a big hippie, really.
Yeah, isn't he like an eco terrorist in the Ultimates? I don't think I've read that in a while.
Yeah. He's a green guy, you know, so he's very anti-establishment, you know, doesn't trust any government and everything. And he's interesting, you know, I mean, each one of them, the conversations are interesting because they believe in different things. But I'm always amazed, like, I mean, I follow everyone on Twitter, you know, I mean, I follow people I vehemently disagree with and people I really like, you know. But my friendship circle is like that as well. My friendship circle is a very wide mix of people. And that's why dinner parties at my house are great, or nights in the pub with my friends are great, because we all believe totally different things. Like, I hate the monothink. Monothink is, you know, the biggest problem in the 21st century. And for people to think outside of that, to be shot down, to me, that's fascism, you know. Like, I hate that.
Yeah, yep, for sure. yeah, there's definitely a lot of different views going on in Red Sun Superman and in your comics as well. But yeah, that's why I love it, because, you know, you can read it and you get the fact that Superman is evil, but it doesn't feel like you're being preached to. Even though, you know, communism, you have the gulags, which Superman throws people in prison and he brainwashes them, you know, and he does all these things. And you can clearly see that it's not a good thing that he's doing this. But I know in no way do you feel like you're being lectured on, you know, the 12 tenets of communism or something, you know. So,
communist politicians, I'm friendly with quite a few, and they utterly believe they're doing the right thing, right? So
yeah.
I'll say to them, yeah, but you know, an awful lot of people died in the past trying to make this work, and they will say to me, yeah, but next time we do it properly, you know. And this is what happens, you know, every decade has got some new atrocity, but nobody sees themselves ever as the bad guy. You know, you could go to the darkest periods in history and talk to the worst people, and they will always sort of be doing it for reasons that they feel are right, which is so fascinating to me. Like, nobody's ever the villain of their own story.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's what makes it so dangerous sometimes, right? It's like you don't like Magneto doesn't see himself as the villain, right? He sees himself as the savior of mutant kind, even though he wants to genocide all humanity. But that's what makes him such a compelling villain.
The best guy, it's hard to disagree with, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, his sincerity for sure. And then so you also wrote couple of my other favorite comics, Old Man Logan and Civil War, which both became movies. So the Ultimates kind of became the Avengers. Civil War was obviously very influential on the Captain America Civil War, which I think was the second or third. Was that the second one? Second Captain America movie?
Yeah.
And in there too, you have different political views of how, and this kind of is a theme, right? In some of these comics, how should these superheroes be managed? Should they be, you know, with Captain America and, you know, trust their own instincts and, you know, protect their secret identities and their loved ones? Or should they be with Iron Man, who wants to register everybody with the government to make everybody more accountable? And both sides have good points, right? Both sides have good points to this issue, because if superheroes were real and they were blowing up schools and causing chaos and stuff, we'd probably want some sort of accountability.
Yeah.
But then you'd have it too far where, you know, Iron Man is imprisoning his friends in the negative zone, and Captain America is like, this is bad. You know, like, so you can see both sides of the situation. I guess I don't have a specific question, but do you think that dichotomy is kind of relevant to today as well?
Well, I wrote that back in 2006, and I remember thinking America was polarized then.
Yeah.
My God, I haven't seen anything yet. You know, like,
right.
But, you know, it was already splitting into red states and blue states in a way we'd never seen, you know, in modern times. And that was fascinating to me. So Captain America represented, you know, the individual, because he's all about freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And Iron Man represented the state, really, you know. So, because he's very pragmatic as well, you know. So it was a very interesting concept, you know, like the idea of if superheroes did exist in the real world, and I always like to take the stories back to that. If there are kids who could push over buildings or blow up cities or whatever, of course you're not going to just let them run around wearing a mask and you don't know who they are. They could have criminal records.
Right.
You know, they could be crazy people. They could have terrible histories and everything. You know, they could be awful things going on there. So you would want some kind of level of accountability. They would be on some kind of register. But at the same time, that's my head says that, but my heart likes the idea of superheroes being free and out there helping people, and they're above the law in a sense that they can't be corrupted, you know. So I kind of like the idea of guys like Batman and Superman out there as well, you know. So like, so it was one of those nice situations where they were both correct.
Mm-hmm.
Like Captain America utterly believed in what he was and he was right, and Iron Man believed in what he was doing too, because you can't let this stuff go unchecked. So it was really interesting. I'd say about 50% of the audience went with either character.
Yeah,
and that's what blew up. I mean, it's still Marvel's biggest selling graphic novel of all time.
Right,
you know. So excited. And it's funny because I thought, well, America's going to be at peace with itself in a couple of years' time, you know, but that's never happened yet. You know, we're 60 years on, people are still buying this book.
Right. Yeah. And in the movie, how do you think your comics in general translate to the movies? Do you think they capture the spirit of what you were trying to do, especially with Civil War?
I can't actually remember, to be honest. Like, I only saw Civil War once, and I can't really remember much about it. I remember the opening. I kind of can't remember the rest of it. But, you know, with my own stuff, I'm always a producer on my own films, so I'm always very careful.
Okay.
To make with them. So when I started my own company, when I left Marvel for Kingsman, Kick-Ass, Wanted, now all the stuff at Netflix, like, you know, Super Crooks, Magic Order, Jupiter's Legacy and everything, all of those things, I just make sure I'm in there, you know, and trying to kind of make it as good as it can be. I mean, we're really lucky, this generation of comic book creators, we owned all of our own material. Whereas the guys who created Superman, Batman, you know, they sold this stuff for pennies compared to what the companies made out of them. So so we were, you know, it was great. We had such an amazing time to be doing this type of job. Like, that's what Stan Lee said to me. He said, like, don't just do Marvel stuff. Go and create your own things as well and own your own things. So my friends and I, we had Millarworld and we sold that to Netflix.
Yeah.
So now Netflix own Millarworld, but we all get paid handsomely for it. You know?
I would hope so, yeah. that's cool. Yeah. So, one of my favorites is Old Man Logan, and the movie is pretty different, you know, than the book. But I think it still captures that that feel you were going for. I mean, it's you kind of have Logan as this, you know, almost this Wild West sort of universe in the comic, you know, where all the villains win, they team up and defeat all the heroes and kill everybody, and Logan is one of the few left, and he's on this farm, and he is pretty much a pacifist, and it's a little bit different than the movie. I loved the movie too. The movie was great, but it wasn't. It didn't have the wasn't as colorful as the comic.
Well, they didn't have a lot of the characters, you know, because it was made at Fox. They only had access to the X-Men characters and a couple of the Fantastic Fours. Whereas my thing, I was lucky at the whole Marvel Universe.
Yeah, that's...
But yeah, I mean, it's funny you say a Western, because I drew a picture, and all my stories start with a drawing, you know, and I drew a picture of Wolverine, and he didn't have his claws out, he had a bow, and he was, like, doing his land, and I was like, why is he on his land? And I drew this farm around him and everything, and he was an older guy. And I thought it was kind of interesting, and I wrote a little note, he hasn't popped his claws and killed anyone in 50 years. Then I thought, why hasn't he done that, you know? And then I kind of grew the story out of that, and he was a Logan who'd done a terrible thing, and he was refusing to be out there again, mm-hmm. you know, doing what he did. Until he's, it's like Clint Eastwood in Unforgiven was my big inspiration, you know? Yeah. Until he has to reach for that gun again, you know, it's like, he's a pacifist until things get so bad he has to become the ultimate killing machine again.
Right.
And the thing about those stories is that people love those stories of a guy who's brilliant at this stuff, who has to hang up his gun, you know, or his claws or whatever, you know, and then he's back for one last job. It's always satisfying, isn't it, to see somebody great back for one last job. And I think, you know, I just played it like a Western, really, you know. Yeah. I Clint Eastwood was the inspiration for Wolverine back in the 70s, the early 70s, when he was created, The Man with No Name. And I just took it to its logical conclusion, which was Unforgiven. That was my plan.
Yeah, well, there's something about the definition of meekness, you know, Christ talks about meekness. Meekness isn't being a pushover, right? Meekness is being someone capable of violence, but choosing not to use it, you know, capable of force and choosing and having mastery over themselves, right?
Yeah.
And Wolverine in this comic and Clint Eastwood, you know, in Unforgiven, those are guys that have mastery over themselves, but when it comes to it, they can push back, you know, and that's what makes it, I think that's what makes it so compelling, as especially Wolverine as a character in that comic. He's capable of great violence, but he chooses not to use it until he absolutely has to defend, you know, his family or whatever, you know, or to take revenge. So I think that's what makes it so popular.
I think that turn the other cheek once, I think that's probably, maybe that's a Scottish thing or something, you know.
Once. But
you
will turn...
Come after them,
you know? Right. You get one. Dude, slap my other cheek, I'm coming after you now.
Yeah,
it's fascinating. And so I want to kind of talk about we've talked about this a little bit, but your overall kind of philosophy of storytelling. You in an article in The Spectator last year, you mentioned that audiences don't, and you've talked about this, audiences don't want to be preached to. But you mentioned they want something dark and edgy. And how do you go about, I mean, we've kind of talked about this a little bit, but how do you go about crafting your story without being preachy?
I think it's really easy. You just write something entertaining, you know, and it's if I was a preacher, my job would be preaching, but my stories are hopefully entertaining. You know, that's, people have tough lives generally, you know, most people have tough lives. Most people have to be paid to go to work, you know, like it's you know, it's not easy. So at nighttime, it's nice to have some escapism and to kind of get away from it all. And I think my job is, somebody who's had a hard day or going through a tough period in their life, they have 2 hours where they don't think about it with a movie, or 20 minutes where they don't think about it with a comic book, you know, and they're just entertained. I think that's your job. And if people get some extra level out of your stories, great. You hopefully imbue them with lots of layers. But yeah, I don't want to write pamphlets. You know, I want to write comic books.
Right. Yep. I know the same author, Tim Powers, what he'll do is he'll have his wife read his stories before publishing it, you know, and he'll look for things that he, you know, his stories do have a point, right? It's not like he's writing without a point, but he tries not to be overly like dialectical in his storytelling. So have his wife read it and make sure everything makes sense. And then like, oh, you should probably edit this part because it comes off a little strong and you want it to be a little bit more opaque, you know, or something, whatever, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
It's, you want to tell a good story first and then the message will come through like somehow, you know, through characters' actions or whatever, but it's not because you're intentionally like putting something in there. Like Tolkien said that his work was Catholic unconsciously first, and then he made it a little bit more explicit as he went forward, made it more deliberate. But it was unconsciously Catholic while he was writing it. And I think that's probably the best approach. Unless you're writing a story about a priest, you know, about, you know, then obviously it has to be more explicit. But
Your point of view is not important. I think, you know, like, I think that your character's point of view is what's important, you know? And it's funny, this week I've watched Jaws and I watched The Godfather. And in the last 7 days, I watched Jaws and The Godfather. And those are probably two, if not the two best movies ever made, right? You know, they're just absolutely perfect films. I watched Jaws in the cinema with, you know, like a bunch of strangers who've seen it a million times and everybody was still wild. This movie could have been out this week as opposed to 45 years ago or whatever. And what was really interesting is it had no message. There's no message in Jaws and there's no message in The Godfather. They're pieces of art, you know. Yeah. I take things out of them yourself, you know. There's little moments that mean something to you and they touch you or they frighten you or they make you laugh or whatever. But there's no message, you know. And I think sometimes a message is a crutch for bad writing. You know, like if you don't have a story, you shove a message in there, you know. Like I think that these are the two purest pieces of Western cinema I can think of. I absolutely love both films. And they told me nothing except what people are like, you know, like what it's like to be or what it's like to be, you know, born into a family like that.
Right.
But you make them.
Yeah, the message of Jaws is sharks are scary. I think that's pretty obvious. one of my friends on Twitter, he's also a big fan of yours. And I asked him, like, what would you ask Mark Millar about comics, about whatever? And so this is one of his questions. So you've written a lot on traditions being passed on through generations into new times. And there's tension in today's comics over how the tradition is meant to be passed. So there's deconstruction, you know, like deconstructing the character or new faces and old masks, you know, incorporating political trends. How do you see this tension playing out, and how do you come up with how do up and coming writers balance respect for what came before while building off of that into something new?
I think they'll do it automatically. They'll do it subconsciously. I think they just write a story to entertain themselves. I mean, that's the biggest advice I'd give to everyone. When I was in my 20s, when I was starting out, I was going nowhere with my career for years. You know, I was trying stuff, and what I was trying to do was appeal to what an editor wanted or appeal to what I thought an audience wanted. But what I did when I was 29 is I sat down and wrote for the first time ever a story for me that I would want to read. And then the enthusiasm I had for it by osmosis, other people luckily got into it too, you know. So I can just write a story that you find entertaining. And if you love comic books, if you love these characters, that's just going to come through naturally when you start writing. Never analyze it too much. You know, don't worry about it. Just write the story that you want to write.
Yeah, I think having a genuine love of the characters and what you're doing is probably sufficient, right, to continue on with these stories. It's when you start, like what we've been talking about, it's when you start shoehorning messages in or taking the character, and because you don't like what they represent, and then twisting them into something that they're not, right? There's something it's not genuine about your storytelling, right? It's because you have to come from a place of love, I think.
We see it with the movies, I think. You know, you look at the last 22 years, 23 years now of comic cinema since Blade, which was kind of the first one of these things. The people who are doing them really like the characters generally. They really like the franchise. Like Sam Raimi couldn't believe he was doing Stan Lee and Steve Ditko's Spider-Man. He was loving it. You could enjoy. Christopher Nolan read every single Batman comic there's ever been before he started, you know. So like the guys who come to it with a passion, they're the guys who do the best work. And we can see it, you can tell, I won't name names, but, you know, you can see the projects where they did not care. This was a gig to get them another gig, you know, they didn't grow a love of this stuff, and that comes across in the work, you know. But I think it's the same with comic books too. If you love it, then that love is contagious.
Yeah, yeah. That's how I'm studying to be an entomologist, so studying insects. And my entomology professor in college had that love, that infectious love of the subject matter, and that's what made me want to do it. Right? It's because she loved it so much, she found it so interesting, and she had this genuine infectious love that she just kind of radiated off of her about the subject matter. I'm like, oh, this is really cool. I want to do this now, you know. And so that it does have an effect. Like genuinely loving what you're doing has an effect on the quality of the work, I think.
I think whatever you do, whatever line of work you're in, you know, and take it back to Catholicism, I think we lucked out by having really great teachers at my school and great priests in my parish, you know, who I can't imagine a downside to all. I really only had a nice experience of the whole thing, you know. So I think I was blessed in a way, you know. I was lucky growing up where I did and only having those positive things around us like that, you know, because around the world you kind of see that it can go the other way sometimes as well, you know. Like my experience of Catholicism and Christianity is a good one, you know. For me, it's people trying to help the poor, trying to do things for other people and everything. It's things that's hard to argue with.
Yeah, for sure. And then I guess we'll do a couple more questions here.
I was going to say my wife's going to kill me because we're supposed to be going out for dinner.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, we'll do...
I'm good for another couple of minutes. I can hear her.
Yeah, it's like almost 6 o'clock for you guys in the UK, I think. So yeah, we'll shorten it up here. So we'll do two more questions. One of them is kind of goofy, and it'll be at the end. This one, so I recently discovered the works of Darwin Cook, who wrote DC's New Frontier, which I'm loving. You know, I'm reading it right now. It's fantastic. And just his art style and his storytelling ability is really something else. But I went online. I'm like, I don't watch like interviews with him or whatever, you know. And I found one where he was asked. It's about a minute long, you know. He was asked, "What do you think DC and Marvel should do? Should change their business model and the way they do business?" And Cook said, and I'm quoting him here, they should stop catering to the perverted needs of 45-year-old men. And what he meant was, he doesn't want to see Batman and Superman and all these characters do horrible things to other people, swearing, or like, they, you know, he's like, they should be trying to gear these stories towards a new generation, right? Without alienating them with all these shocking things. Like, he mentioned Batman forcing people to eat rats. I don't remember that comic, but but you know, or like someone being raped, you know, on the page, you know. He's like, I don't want to see that. I don't want to see Superman or Batman swearing. I don't want to see that. What do you make of his assessment? So I tend to agree, but
I think Superman, Batman, these characters are all ages characters, you know. Mm-hmm. So like, but at the same time, I think there's room for everything.
Yeah.
So if all comic books were aimed at children, I'd stop reading them, you know, because I'm a middle-aged guy, you know. But at the same time, if they were only aimed at middle-aged men, kids, you don't have a new generation of people coming in. So I think the balance is what's important. You know, you've got to do stuff that appeals to kids and adults and have a read of books, maybe some younger reader ones. Imagine cinema, for example, to say that all cinema should be aimed at one particular age group would be crazy, you know. So what you do is you spread it around. But I do think that we need to rethink the way the traditional Marvel and DC characters are done, because kids aren't reading them really generally. They aren't. And I think this goes by decades. And what's really interesting is that my middle daughter in particular, she's now 10, she absolutely loves Silver Age DC comics. And we discovered this in lockdown. It was really interesting. I read her some late 1950s collections, those big omnibuses you can buy in comic stores, and she loved them, and she was burning through them. So I would read them in bed to her at night time, but then she would read them herself during the day. She would really get into them, and she read every Superman comic from maybe, she was really into Lois Lane as well, she liked the Lois Lane comics, but she read everyone from maybe 1955 to about 1971, and there was something about that period of stuff that's just so magical. It's like fairy tales, the kids really get into it. And we've never been able to capture it again. I don't know what it is. I've never been able to do it. My peers have never been able to do it. Even the gym before me couldn't. But the guys from 60, 70 years ago, they had some magic ink in their pen. The kids loved the stuff. And those books used to sell between 800,000 and 1 million copies every month. Those things were huge. So whatever those guys were doing, I don't know. I mean, I don't even know how it would go if you repackaged that old stuff, because my daughter didn't even realize these were old comics. She thought these were contemporary comics.
Yeah.
So I think there's something in that for sure, but I want to still read comics too, so I like the idea of it being, you know, something for everyone. It's no bad thing.
Sure. Yep. I think that's a good place to leave it. So I have one final question for you, and then you can go to dinner. So this is a goofier question, but I ask this of every guest. This podcast is called I Might Believe in Fairies, because I'm personally agnostic about the subject of fairies and whether they exist, whatever. I obviously believe angels and demons exist as a Catholic, but fairies, I don't know. So I ask my guests, Mark Millar, do you believe in fairies?
It's such a brilliant question. I've never been asked this. I believe in God.
Yep.
I believe in angels. I believe in demons. Until I was 7, I thought Superman was a real guy.
Yeah.
But I believe in fairies.
What did you say?
But I don't believe in fairies, you know, but like, So I believe in everything else, I think, except fairies.
You'd be surprised at the different answers I get when I ask different Orthodox, Catholic, Anglican, you know, writers what they think about fairies. And some of them are like, oh yes, they're very much real. Oh yeah. Other people are like, no, that's ridiculous, you know, and everything in between. You know, it's like Tim Powers said that he, with the fairies that tricked Arthur Conan Doyle, right, with the famous photographs in Scotland, I think. He's like, you know, we never actually saw the real photographs. So until I see those real photographs, because Arthur Conan Doyle wouldn't be fooled by those fake photographs with the strings and stuff. He's a smart guy. He probably saw real photographs of real fairies. So until we see those, maybe.
I do a PS on this, that people should look this up. The Arthur Conan Doyle thing is really interesting. One of my friends wrote an article about this recently, and he interviewed the children of the two ladies, you know, who were the photographs of the fairies. And what they surmised, that's a great article, you must read this, it's really cool. He got her to admit what happened, and they said they faked the photographs, but they did so because they had encountered something real previously.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't articulate what they had found. So what they said was, they reckon one of the girls was psychic, and she could see something moving around her. And she told everyone about it, and Arthur Conan Doyle sat with her and utterly believed her, because she was not lying. You know, she saw something moving around her, but she was so embarrassed because she couldn't actually show any evidence that's why they did the faking it, so that they could at least show something and show that she wasn't crazy. Wow. So it's a great area. It's quite an interesting one. So I'd recommend checking out the article. It's like a big 6-page interview with the family. Women, but it's really cool.
Awesome. I'll try to find that and put it in the show notes. Well, thank you so much. This has been really fun. And I just can't believe it happened. So if you have any final thoughts, go ahead, and then you can go off to dinner. I gotta go eat lunch.
I think you've got all the wisdom out of me. I don't think I've got any wisdom left. I don't think I've got anything good. But like, it's just a pleasure, you know. And what's lovely is talking about something a little different as well. You know, I'm going to have to go back and check out the other podcasts. These sound really interesting. I hope you get more comic book guys on here too.
Yeah, there's the amount of Catholic comic book creators are very slim. So,
Frank Miller's a Catholic.
Who is that?
Frank Miller. He's a
Catholic. Oh, Frank Miller. Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, yeah, he's still alive, so maybe. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for listening. I just wanted to put in a reminder that we have the I Might Believe in Fairies t-shirts available now for purchase for anybody. So just message me on Twitter at Aaron Erber. That's my Twitter handle. Facebook under my name. Or you can reach out to me on Patreon. Patrons on Patreon receive a 20% discount for their t-shirt. So if you are a patron or you want to be a patron, please visit my Patreon account and subscribe, and any help is really appreciated. And I also want to remind people that the book club discussion for Tim Powers' The Anubis Gates will occur sometime in mid-November, so working on picking a date, but it'll probably be right in the middle of the month. So patrons, you can participate in that discussion. And anybody who wants to be a patron can sign up and then participate in that discussion. So I'll be having my friends Dan and Andrew come back to talk about that book if they're available, possibly another special guest. So just keep that in mind. And if you want to support the podcast, please do. And don't forget to rate the podcast on any place that you listen to podcasts, like Spotify or Apple. And subscribe and to hit the little subscribe button. I know it's a pretty hard thing to do, but hit that subscribe button. And if you can, leave a review. Thank you, and God bless.
Thank you for listening to this episode of I Might Believe in Fairies. Please leave a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Please follow me on Twitter at Aaron Erber and like me on Facebook. If you're excited to see where the podcast is going and want to offer some support for the project, you can find me on Patreon. Music is by Alexander Nakarada, and podcast art was designed by my wonderful sister-in-law, Linnea Kisby. Until next time, talk to you soon.